this edition of Tough Shell Podcast with Rex and Lav. Happy 250th birthday to America. Happy 70th birthday, actually, to Mark Lavner, my father. Rex, that's why I'm wearing the Weber Kettle polo coming off the heels of this holiday weekend. We have a lot to get to on the PGA Tour with the John Deere Classic. Chris Goddard shooting that Sunday 62. Pretty emotional victory with his brother on the bag. But this was a tough one to watch, was it not? With Ben Cole having an opportunity to win for the very first time on the PGA Tour and kicking it away at the last. So what do you think as we sit here on Monday morning? Was this more about Chris Goddard, or are you going to be remembering the John Deere Classic for what happened to Ben Coles?
I'm glad you cleared up the shirt, because all I saw was kind of an ink blot test. I was seeing all of my fears and hopes and everything that I don't want to see in my life. It scared me to death. I didn't know what I was actually looking at. And it's the cliched argument that we always have. And I'm going to struggle with this one, because I think, and I want to get into this a little bit later, that Chris Goddard is possibly on his way to becoming the player of the year on the PGA Tour. And it's a debate. It's a good debate. I mean, I'm not going to say it's
we're going to have that debate.
Any stretch of the imagination, but it's Ben Coles. When you look at what he's done really over the last 2 months, this was his ninth consecutive start. I did the math, if you were curious. I know you were curious what I was doing all this afternoon while I was waiting for you to call. Would you like to know, over those nine consecutive weeks on the road, how many miles he has traveled? Obviously, not all by driving, but many of them by driving. 3,601 miles, and that goes, it crisscrosses the country, that goes to Canada, that goes to the U.S. Open, that goes to the U.S. Open qualifying site in Virginia. He has done so much the last 2 months, and yet you look at what happened today. We can get into the idea of, and I think the CBS crew did a good job of sort of breaking down what they saw in the moment. It's clear he sped up over that last shot, but I don't think you can blame what happened on that last shot. If we could go back to the 17th hole, it was a par five. He should have birdied that. It wouldn't have been an issue coming down the stretch. He wouldn't have had to press and try to make a bogey to avoid that playoff. It never really goes down to one shot. I know that's what we're going to remember. But I'm going to lean back into nine consecutive starts. I think there's something to be said for just tired, man. I think at some point, mentally, physically, you just
he was leading the golf tournament. He didn't seem tired when he was leading the golf tournament by three shots on the back nine.
But you can see the same things in his body language, and I'll go back to the Wingfoot U.S. Open with Phil Mickelson, the way he was able to kick that one away, that you saw in Phil Mickelson on that Sunday at Wingfoot, where he just started to walk slower. He started to get a little slumped shoulders. He started hitting shots like Ben Coles on the 18th hole that you're just not accustomed to seeing him do. And I think I'm not going to make excuses for him, because certainly this was one of those cases where you had a chance to control your own destiny and you weren't able to execute. And this is something he and his sports psychologist could probably spend a lot of time talking about. But yes, to answer your question, it's going to be Ben Coles, simply because of how tragic that felt coming down the stretch.
Yeah, I don't know if it's mental exhaustion. I don't know if it's physical exhaustion. Nine in a row. He isn't going to play 10 in a row unless he pulls out of the ISCO championship. He said, telling reporters afterward, that he didn't intend to play this coming week on the PGA Tour. He said, look, I don't have an opportunity to take a break. Right now he's sixth on the Korn Ferry Tour standing, so he doesn't feel secure enough. And mathematically, he is not secure enough to take that time off. And so he continues to play, dabbling a little bit on the PGA Tour as well as the Korn Ferry Tour. I don't chalk this up, Rex, to mental or physical exhaustion. I chalk this up to being it really hard to win golf tournaments on the PGA Tour, particularly for a player who has not been there. And the CBS crew referenced the 2024 Byron Nelson, what happened to Ben Coles there as well. That one was actually a little bit more tragic. You might not remember this one, but 2 years ago at TPC Craig Ranch, Ben Coles was leading by a single shot, heading to the par 5 18th hole in great position to win for the very first time on the PGA Tour. He is greenside in two shots. Again, position A if you're trying to close out a golf tournament on the PGA Tour. His bunker shot does not reach the green. He chips it up to 5 feet, and he doesn't make the putt to make the only bogey of the entire day on the 18th hole and ends up losing by a shot. So I guess in this respect, it pales in comparison to the hurt and the sting that he experienced at the Nelson. But Rex, I mean, tied for the lead, 175 yards. Said he was in between an 8-iron and a 9-iron. Tried to take a little bit off the 8, got a little quick, tugged it into the water, just the second ball all day into the water. This one's going to hurt. But look, kudos to Ben Coles for standing and facing the music. I was a little bit surprised we did not hear from him on the CBS broadcast, but he met with reporters, answered a handful of questions, was very professional, was unemotional, said sort of all the right things afterward as well.
And it's been an amazing run. I think you can always fall back on the idea that he is playing fantastic golf. That can be your solace that gets you through these next few weeks that are going to be difficult on the road. And you are 100% correct. And we've touched on this many, many times on this podcast. The idea that winning on the PGA Tour is just hard. I think sometimes it's easy to discount how actually difficult it's going to be. And I'll also give Ben a monsoon of credit, as you like to think I say all the time.
Thank you.
That's the catchphrase.
Trademark it.
Yes. If you're playing the game at home, now's the time to take a drink. I'll give him a monsoon of credit on this front, because making the double bogey at the last cost him a lot of really valuable points. If you look at where he was going to be projected to where he ended up right now, I think he's right around 100th on the points list. That's important. There's only five full field events remaining on the PGA Tour schedule before we get to the playoffs. That's obviously not counting the Open Championship, which he's not qualified for. I just think in this particular situation, it would have been so easy for someone to think to themselves, all right, I might not win this with a heroic shot here, but I could certainly not only lose this tournament, but I can lose a lot of what I built up over the course of this week, and to play it safe. And to just make sure that I don't finish anything worse than second place. Give yourself a chance to stay in the game. And he didn't do that. It's clear he stayed aggressive. He was going at that flag. He wanted to make birdie. I think you need to give him a lot of credit on that front.
I certainly think that was a misfire. Of all the ways that I thought Ben Coles was going to lose the golf tournament, tugging it left into the water was not the one. I thought potentially he would play conservatively, short and right, maybe have a three putt, or just put it in that nervy range. And that's how he loses the golf tournament. So it's certainly a shocking end to the golf tournament. But look, Rex, there was a number of players on that final leaderboard who were sort of in a similar position to Ben Coles. I think you would have been interested to see how they would have handled that scenario where you do have a three-shot lead. You see a challenger like Chris Goddard, who is now a five-time winner on the PGA Tour, coming up from behind you and shooting 62 and putting an immense amount of pressure on you as you try to close out a golf tournament. Lee Hodges had only won one time on the PGA Tour. That was 3 years ago. Lucas Glover was trying to sort of erase some of the demons that he'd had this season, win for the first time in a couple of years as well. You had a Mac Meisner. You had Jackson Suber. You had Doug Gim. You had Zach Blair, all of whom finished inside the top 10, all of whom really factored into the story over the weekend. I don't think this was necessarily a story that's unique to Ben Coles. I think it's just really eminently difficult to win on the PGA Tour. And I think it's most shocking for Ben Coles because of the way that he started this golf tournament. If you're 36 years old trying to win for the first time on the PGA Tour, going out and shooting 30 on that front nine, having the time of your life, chatting up Lee Hodges on each and every hole, like he looked so comfortable, to then see how it played out over those five or six holes is just really, really surprising for a player who a couple hours earlier looked carefree and in complete control. That's pressure. That is what pressure looks like to close out a PGA Tour event, and Ben Coles unfortunately experienced it.
No, and there is some irony here. I think GolfDigest.com just posted a story this weekend about how players deal with this type of pressure when you get down the stretch, when you have an opportunity to win, when you have an opportunity to fulfill all of those dreams that you've had for 37 years of your life. And this story sort of points out it's normally the easier things. It's the easier things that becomes so difficult. It's not executing the tee shot. He hit a great, perfect tee shot on the 72nd hole. As a sublime ball striker, I think that was the difficult part for him.
I love, Rex, the story and the elevation and the ascension of Chris Goddard, who, as I mentioned, is now a five-time winner on the PGA Tour, a three-time winner in 2026, putting him right up there with Matt Fitzpatrick, who some could argue really has 2.5 wins on the PGA Tour this season because he partnered with his brother Alex to win the Zurich Classic, the team event. But this is a dude who won the Sony Open, Phoenix Open, and now the John Deere Classic. Hasn't done it in a signature event, has not really produced in the major championships in 2026. But what did you make of Chris Goddard getting across the line again on the heels of that Sunday 62?
You love it when a guy comes from five back, because I'm always curious of what we're talking about. The mentality must be for Ben Coles as he's finishing up trying to do something he's dreamt of his entire life. But you're a player of Chris Goddard's caliber, and going into that final round, knowing that you're five shots back, you know you've got to do something pretty special. It's the magic of being able to pull it off. That's the pretty shocking part here. And I'll go back to the idea, and this is also a bit cliched, but when Chris Goddard is playing his best golf, you go back to the idea that a powerful driver, a long driver, can be such a dominant weapon in this game. You don't even have to be necessarily straight. to make sure that you can be dominant. You just need to miss in the right places. And that's really what he did. You saw it time and time again. You look at his wins last year at the Scottish, he was third in the field in strokes gained driving. He was first in the field this year in strokes gained driving at the Sony. He was seventh in the field in Phoenix this year when he won. That is such a weapon for him. I'm not going to discount what he did on the greens, especially on Sunday. He had 13 one putts, 120 feet of putts. I mean, he was sublime on the greens, but it's the driver is how he won this, and it's how he's won his other tour titles.
Yeah, that's a great point. Certainly got hot with a putter on the weekend, especially in that final round. I am unabashedly a Chris Gauthier fan. I think if you watch him play golf, spend time, watch him on the range, go out and watch him over the course of a PGA Tour round, I think you'll become a fan of Chris Gauthier as well. There are so many unique elements to him, not just sort of the look and the persona, very much a jock, very much has sort of that athlete swagger. He's got the chains. He's got the ungripped glove.
Very New Jersey. Casual. That what you're saying. Very New Jersey is what I'm picking up.
Very, very, very New Jersey. You could see him playing third base very, very easily. The guy just goes at it a little bit differently. The training aids he's using, it's not necessarily casual Rex, but it's just like he knows his game. He hasn't really tried to overhaul his swing when it's a little bit unique and unorthodox. From sort of a technique standpoint, but man, can he play a lot of shots. You mentioned not just the driving distance, which is immense. The power that he has on the PGA Tour led the field in total driving distance at TPC Deer Run. But the creativity, the shot shaping, yes, he might prefer to hit the left to right fade shot, but man, the altering of the trajectories, the shapes, taking some off, going at him hard. I mean, he had a 50-foot apex on his drive on the 72nd hole, hit it about 320 yards as well. Some of the saves he made on 15 and 17, threading the needle was sort of a punch shot up in the green, getting up and down from over the back there on 17. A lot of the announcers were saying, boy, this might be a little bit dead. Ended up taking his medicine, hitting it 15 feet past, and making that putt. Yes, I think we all get enamored with the distance. We were certainly impressed with how he has stared down some of the best players in the world, whether it was Rory McIlroy a year ago at the Scottish, whether it was Hideki Matsuyama head-to-head in the playoff this year in Phoenix. But man, the skills that he has, the talent, the confidence that oozes out of him, Chris Gauthier is here to stay. He is going to be a prime-time, big-time player for a number of years to come.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I wanted to bring up last year that Scottish finish. I was at the Scottish Open, and we're going to talk a little bit later in the podcast about Wyndham Clark and crowds and why we think the behavior has gotten so bad. And I'm not saying the behavior at the Scottish Open was bad, but the immense pressure that he felt during that final round when all of Scotland, I would say all of the United Kingdom, wanted Rory McIlroy to win, and he never folded. He didn't blink against the world number two. He didn't blink against a gallery that was clearly against him. I think that's exactly the personification of what you're talking about when he has the swagger. It's Brooks Koepka when Brooks Koepka was winning all of those majors. You just knew that he was going to be bigger, stronger, faster than everyone else on the golf course, and mentally he wasn't going to let anything get to him. I'm going to jump ahead to this player of the year debate, and the reason I brought it up because earlier this season you and I were doing a podcast and you kind of dropped out of nowhere who would you be your player of the year, and I completely blanked on Chris Gauthier. I think I sort of waffled around. Rory McIlroy had just won the Masters. Of course, Scotty had only won once at that point in the season, has still only won once at this point in the season, but those two were at the top of the list and sort of bounced it back and forth. Right now, I think you can make a really good argument that Chris Gauthier should be the player of the year. As you pointed out, he hasn't really done it in the majors. He hasn't even necessarily done it in the signature events, but Phoenix was a very strong field. It's not like we're talking about, might as well get used to saying, Challenger Series event, because that's not what it was. It was a good field. Sony Open, a very solid field. This was a little bit weaker than those two, but you saw what he had to do coming down the stretch. Now, the consistency hasn't been what you've come to expect from certainly Scottie Scheffler. With the one win, he has nine top 10 finishes. I think Matt Fitzpatrick, as you pointed out, with the 2.5 wins, has been a little bit more consistent. But you can make a really good argument for Gauthier right now. We have a lot of time left. We have the five events I've referenced, a major championship, and the three playoff events. But he would be at the top of the ballot right now.
Yeah, it is an interesting discussion. The reason why I caught you off guard a couple months ago is because we do not have a rundown. I know that was mentioned in the YouTube comment section about how you guys just talk for 33 minutes. No, we do not have a rundown. We just sort of have a stream of consciousness, and that's how we formulate our show. We are a little bit more prepared for this one now that Chris Kotterup has three wins, which matches the most on the PGA Tour with Matt Fitzpatrick. One player that I'm going to mention who I would actually, I think, if I were to vote right now on July 6th for my PGA Tour Player of the Year vote, I actually think I would vote for Cameron Young. Players champion, won a signature event in going away fashion, was right there at the Masters, at the year's first major. To me, I don't think, obviously we don't need to vote right now, but I think I would give Cameron Young a slight edge over Matt Fitzpatrick based on the tournaments that he has won. But I also think, Rex, that Scottie Scheffler, again, if we were voting right now on July 6th, he would warrant a lot of consideration from his PGA Tour peers. I know that his only win came all the way back in January at the American Express, but statistically, he is still head and shoulders over every player on the PGA Tour. Not just strokes gained total, but scoring average, just like the statistical dominance through the bag. He's first in birdie average. He's first in bogey avoidance. Like, I know it's not been a 2024 Scottie Scheffler year where he's winning nine times around the world. I know it's just a single victory, and it was in what is still considered a full field event on the PGA Tour. But I still think it would probably be split alongside Matt Fitzpatrick, Cameron Young, and Scottie Scheffler for PGA Tour Player of the Year.
To be clear, neither you nor I have votes in this matter. We are not players on the PGA Tour. They are the ones
we
who
do have the GWA Player of the
we
Year.
We do have the Golf Writers Association of America, which you and I will both vote on. I think it's the statistical example of where we so rarely end up in this conversation. Normally, I end up at Eastlake on Monday, and I'm trying to do all kinds of mental gymnastics coming up with a way to make this a conversation, because it's normally Scottie Scheffler has had a Scottie Scheffler season, and it's going to be some sort of blowout. Or every once in a while, you get a Rory McIlroy who has had a phenomenal season. Very rarely are we this deep in the season. You're right. I think Cameron Young is an absolutely perfect example. Probably, again, not nearly as consistent as Scottie was. When I threw out his stats, I left out probably the most important one. Amidst all of those are four runner-up finishes as well. He's had so many chances to win at big events. And I will always go back to the 2008 conversation. If you remember 2008, Tiger Woods, of course, won the U.S. Open at Torrey Pines on a broken leg, didn't play the rest of the season, obviously, because he was injured. And at the end of the year, Padraig Harrington, who we're going to get to later in this podcast, was voted the PGA Tour Player of the Year. And when we asked Tiger Woods about that, I remember his answer being 2-1. Padraig had won two majors that season. Tiger had only won one, even though he was injured, couldn't play in the final. Well, three then it would have been, or two then, sorry, it would have been, because the PGA was played in August at that time. Couldn't even make the argument. In his mind, it was simple math, 2-1. So I think what happens in 2 weeks' time at the Open Championship will probably factor into this decision very, very heavily, because I could imagine one of those four players we just talked about with Scottie at the top of the list is going to be one of the favorites.
I could see that as well. Obviously, Rory McIlroy won the Masters. If he is in the mix, if he wins another FedEx Cup title, I think that would warrant some serious consideration as well. We might actually, Rex, have a year in which you could go to Eastlake in the Tour Championship. I actually think I'm attending the Tour Championship this year, where the FedEx Cup actually matters. It actually could serve as a tiebreaker of sorts based on just sort of the evenness and how spread out some of the results and the performances are so far in the PGA Tour season. You mentioned 08. I actually think a better comp for this year, at least as it stands right now with a month and a half to go in the PGA Tour season, is what happened back in 2019. Remember, it was Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka who were the two players who were really vying for PGA Tour Player of the Year honors. The player that year that won was Rory McIlroy. Yes, he'd won three times. It was a Players' Championship. It was an RBC Canadian Open, and he won the overall FedEx Cup title. That was viewed by his PGA Tour peers as a more consistent, more well-rounded resume than Brooks Koepka, who won the PGA Championship that year, but sort of had the up-and-down nature that I think you could argue that a handful of these players have. Certainly Cameron Young is in a little bit of a lull right now. Matt Fitzpatrick had a little bit of a dip, a 4 to 6 week dip, as he was going through some driver issues as well. I still like Fitz, but Chris Goddard, but certainly, I sort of to put a bow on the conversation, has put himself squarely in the mix just by sheer volume and winning three times on the PGA Tour. All of them full field events on the PGA Tour. Obviously, Phoenix was the strongest one on his resume in 2026. Anything else, Rex, stand out to you about what happened this week at the John Deere Classics. Great crowd, great support, as always, for a tournament that I think almost everyone is expecting could get relegated in some sort of, in some shape or form to the Challenger Series in 2028.
I think it's a testament to what this tournament means to the PGA Tour. And we're going to continue to have this conversation over the next year and a half before we actually get to 2028 and what the tour is going to become, at least what we know the tour is going to become at this point. And you're right. I think the conversation last week, there was been a lot of ambiguity around the idea of, is this particular event, and you and I have done this week in and week out, would this be a tier one or a tier two event going forward? I don't think that that conversation was had last week. I think what John Deere has done in this community, which is a very small community, is very special. I think what they've created, you looked at the crowds, you looked at the golf course, you look at the players who wanted to be there. Let's keep in mind, Chris Goddard probably shouldn't be playing this week if you're looking at his schedule for 30,000 feet. He's the highest ranked player in the field. He played the U.S. Open. He obviously played last week in Hartford. He'll play this week and he'll go straight to the Scottish, where he'll be the defending champion. There's a lot going on, but they gave him his first, or one of his first sponsor exemptions. They allowed him into this field and he finished up in the top five, I believe, that week, and really gave him confidence that he could compete on the PGA Tour. Zach Johnson skipped a senior major that he probably would have been one of the favorites to play, to come back and to play in this event. All of those things being said, and you're usually on the other side of this conversation, so I'm sure you're going to come out swinging on me. Not every event on the PGA Tour can be tier one. Not every event can go into the Championship Series. There has to be some events that go into the Challenger Series, and I don't think it's going outside the lines to say John Deere is probably going to be one of those events.
Yeah, and it's a shame. And to quote Brian Rolapp, ever since he got in the job about a year ago, he said that we should honor the traditions of the PGA Tour and golf, but we shouldn't be beholden to them. The John Deere Classic, as being a springboard for a lot of players and their future success in the PGA Tour, might be one of those. And look, if it does get relegated to the Challenger Series, and again, we don't know that. That's pure speculation. We're not going to find out the schedule to the first quarter of 2027. If that is the case, then look, you could argue that it's still help serving as a springboard for the future generation, particularly those players who are hungry to get the Challenger Series, the Championship Series. It could serve as a springboard for the players from the PGA Tour University program, like a Preston Stout, who was just playing, has now taken over as the number one ranked amateur. They gave him a start this week. He began the final round four shots off the lead and was very much a part of the story all week long. It has a proud history and tradition on the PGA Tour. What is interesting, though, Rex, because we just had this conversation coming off the Travelers Championship, and obviously it was unbelievable support, unbelievable energy at the golf tournament that I was at the Travelers Championship in TPC River Highlands, which shows out each and every year. You have covered the RBC Heritage and sort of been at Harbortown and experienced that atmosphere over the last couple of years. There's something to be said for these smaller markets and the atmosphere and the energy that they can produce, because it's the only show in town and it really becomes a gathering and a destination for them. And I certainly see the argument that if the PGA Tour is trying to go to these bigger markets, a San Francisco, a Denver, a Philly, a New York, a Boston, would you engender the same sort of emotion? Would you create the same sort of energy and support in those bigger markets where there is so much else to do? And my counter to that has always been, well, you have to have a mix. Like you have to go into the big markets, obviously, because that's just common sense business-wise. But you also have to mix in the Cromwell, Connecticut. You have to mix in the Hilton Head Islands in South Carolina. So you need to have a mix of that. I also, Rex, after seeing the John Deere Classic, it would be very interesting to see if, let's say it was part of the Championship Series, if you did have a Scottie Scheffler, if he did have a Roy McIlroy, if he did have a Xander Schauffele and a Ludvig Åberg and all of the biggest stars of the PGA Tour going to Silvis, Illinois, competing at, you can call it whatever you want, the John Deere Classic, let's just call it for the sake of argument, in the Championship Series, wouldn't that potentially create a bigger spectacle and a better atmosphere and environment than maybe going to a staid TPC golf course in San Francisco? I see that argument as well after this week.
So what you're saying is the John Deere will be a tier one event. It's going to be in the Championship Series. That was a long way for you to get to the idea that you want every event.
I'm not saying it could, I'm not saying it should. I'm saying I think the possibility is interesting, and it makes you wonder the potential of it. If you do go to a golf tournament, look, like this was the strongest feel I think the Deere's had in its tournament history. And it was still Chris Godrup as the highest ranked player in the field. And he was mid-teens in the Fisher World Golf ranking before he just moved up. I believe he's up all the way up to number six. And so, yes, it was the best field in tournament history. It still wasn't spectacular by any stretch of the imagination. And look at the turnout that they had for all four tournament days at TPC Deer Run.
No, and I'm not going to sit here and argue that, because we have made this argument time and time again, and I've had officials from the PGA Tour make the same argument to me that what they've created in Hilton Head and what they've created in Hartford, and you can go across the PGA Tour landscape and find these really special events, not major markets by any stretch, not even in the top 50 when it comes to markets, but what they've created is really cool, and the PGA Tour is just trying to replicate that. We weren't able to do this podcast last Sunday because of the playoff, and you were in Hartford, and we had to finish it up on Monday morning. But one of the topics in our rundown, yep, it's true, we do have a rundown from time to time, was the idea of, okay, what could we possibly be looking at in 2028? Because we have a bit of a better outline right now. And I knew you were going to go down this road. There is essentially only five openings right now on the PGA Tour if you want to be in that championship series event, because you can do the simple math. It's going to be the eight events that you already have, which are signature events, last week in Hartford being one of them. It's going to be by all accounts, two playoff events. That gets you to 10. You have four majors. Those are going to be in the championship series. And you have the Players' Championship. That's 15. They're counting in this list whatever cup is being held that year. So it would either be the Ryder Cup or the President's Cup. And they want to have somewhere in the neighborhood of 22 events. It's really easy to start filling in the gaps. We've had this conversation before. Torrey Pines, you would imagine, has to go into the championship series. Phoenix has to go into the championship series. By my understanding is Atlanta will stay in the mix, probably not as the tour championship, but it wants to remain in the mix. Same thing for Memphis and FedEx. And then we've had the conversation at length about the Charles Schwab Challenge at Colonial in a major market. Now you're leaving. We've already gone past see, this is the problem. We've already rolled through the stop sign here, and you're just throwing more in there. And we're going to talk about the Scottish Open later in this podcast. There were so many good events on the PGA Tour schedule. This is actually a good problem. I know it's not great when you're talking about specific people in specific markets, but if you're Rolap and his team, this is a very good thing to have a list of such really good tournaments that you're trying to whittle it down to just 22 to 23 events. It's going to be difficult because, as you pointed out time and again, you could sit here and keep rattling off names, and you keep sitting here rattling off really good tournaments, but they all can't land in the championship series.
I'm not saying that the John Deere Classic will become a championship series event in 2020.
Who are you taking out then? I just read the list. Who are you taking out?
I'm merely exploring the possibility and just in my mind wondering if that is a better proposition for the PGA Tour to have the John Deere Classics of the world be elevated and bring the biggest stars to a place where you already have immense energy, entertainment, and atmosphere, as opposed to going to a big market where attention is going to be divided with most likely some sort of TPC venue and trying to create that atmosphere. We saw it this past year at the Cadillac Championship at Doral. It was a huge happening. You and I have both covered that event when it was a big deal. You, back in the mid-2000s, it was one of the biggest events on the PGA Tour. It fell flat this year at the Cadillac Championship. Was it because of the timing? Certainly, there was a Formula One race that was going on during the same week. It was hot weather. It was a blowout. I get it. There was a number of factors. We're going to see if a different positioning on the schedule in 2027 makes a bigger deal in Doral. But I think that's sort of a cautionary tale for the PGA Tour going forward, that just because you have this big media market and makes a lot of sense from a business standpoint, does it create the right sort of energy and the right sort of product, as opposed to bringing the best players on the PGA Tour to a place that you already know can be a home run?
No, and to your point, we have been to New York City. By we, I mean the PGA Tour. They have been to Boston, and all of us, we have been to these major markets, and there is a reason why you left, whatever that reason was. Maybe you didn't have the corporate support. Maybe you didn't have the community support. Maybe the golf course didn't add up. You're going to have to get it right if you're Brian Rolap and his team. I know they want an event in the New York City area, but this has been tried time and time again with little success, because there's a reason why we don't go to New York. So it's going to be the challenge, but they made it clear in that release that major markets in New York City was atop them. Washington, D.C., Seattle, Denver. Mm-hmm. We can go down the names that they listed are also going to be in this mix. So the list that I just gave you is optimistic for a lot of these tournaments, because the fact of the matter is there aren't going to be enough spots.
Shout out Claire Peterson, the former tournament director at the John Deere Classic, so who is really a trailblazer in a lot of respects, issuing sponsor exemptions and invitations to the top up-and-coming players. Chris Godrup among them 4 years ago, writing to the tournament directors, pleading for a sponsor exemption, saying that I promise I will make you proud if I get a spot in your golf tournament. Finished in the top five there, kickstarted what is now an ascendant career on the PGA Tour, a five-time winner on the PGA Tour, and he has certainly made the John Deere Classic tournament organizers look very smart, and certainly he has made them proud. All right, that's a wrap-up for this John Deere Classic recap. Coming up after the break, we're going to have Love It or Lav It, plenty to chew on, including live golfers playing in this week's Scottish Open, Padraig Harrington, Stewart Cink. Is that the best rivalry in golf? Yes, or even semi-serious. Plenty more coming up after the break. All right, Rex, it's time for another edition of the world-famous Love It or Lav It segment. If you're new here, first of all, welcome. The rules of the game are simple. You either love an idea or you lav it. You're skeptical. You hate on it. Pretty self-explanatory. Let's first start with this week's Scottish Open, an event that you and I always look forward to. John Rahm, Tyrrell Hatton, among the LIV players who are in the field this week. Are you loving or laving the LIV players actually being in the same field as PGA Tour players, because this is a co-sanctioned event between the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour?
See, you don't explain the rules of the game right. It's even named after you. The reason it's Love It or Lav It is because lav, you, are a bit of a curmudgeon. So the idea being you're either going to love something or you're not going to love it quite so much. So that's where the lav it comes from. This particular topic I absolutely love. We've talked now for 4 years, more or less, about what the fans want. Quote, unquote, the fans want. They want to see the top players together more often on these classic venues. Love going to the Scottish Open. It's going to break my heart not being there this week. You and I will be on the desk here in Connecticut co-hosting Golf Today together. However, this one is going to be awesome because you have truly the best players in the world. And the only way we've seen them over the last essentially 4 years is at major championships. There were some LIV players in the field last week at the DP World Tour event in Germany. I think this is a good step in the right direction. We have no idea what's going to happen with LIV Golf. We have no idea what the direction of that league is now that they're going to lose funding from the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia at the end of this year. But this at least is a crack in the door. This gives the top players an opportunity to get together more often, and that's only good for the fans and the game.
I love it too. As you mentioned, We just saw the BMW International Open. You saw Carlos Ortiz, Joaquin Niemann among those who have been in action on the European Tour over the past couple of weeks. Now we're going to be getting John Rahm and Tyrrell Hatton, who again, look, they've paid their penalties. They handle all the fines and the sanctions that the European Tour had doled out to them over the past couple of years. They've committed to playing a handful of events to help those tournaments out as well. The rules are the rules, and though they are now full members on the DP World Tour, and this is the one tournaments that they want to play in. Unity, as you mentioned, seems a long way off in the world of golf, and this seems like a great compromise, in my opinion. It's a great way for the best players in the world to be together more often, even if it's just 4 to 6 more times throughout the course of the year in 2026, and you don't have to deal with all the resentment and the bitterness and the hostility and the jealousy and the rules and the regulations and the returning member programs and all of the other things that would go back with reincorporating them into regular week-to-week PGA Tour life. So if we can see them in a handful of national opens, if we're going to be opening up the fall on the PGA Tour to having some more international events as well, I am all for the idea of having LIV players in these events if it makes sense and if they're co-sanctioned by these tours. All right, second topic for today was something that Jordan Spieth broached in his pre-tournament press conference at the John Deere Classic, the idea that the PGA Tour needs to crack down and, quote, tackle gambling because it is on the verge of going over the edge. Are you loving or laving Jordan's ideas?
Well, I'm loving the ideas. I'm laving the actual notion of what he's getting to. And it's important to point out that he is a
multi-pronged.
You like how I did that, didn't you? It's a bit of a two-step. He is a voice that should be trusted on this. Jordan Spieth was on the PGA Tour policy board when the PGA Tour was making the decisions to get into sports gaming. Every other league has done it. This isn't something that the PGA Tour did, but it took a while for the tour to wrap their minds around the idea of how this is going to impact the game. And there was a lot of integrity issues within the game that they needed to address. The one that I think everyone was afraid of, including Jordan Spieth and everyone else on the board at that time, by my understanding, was what would happen if someone in the crowd tried to influence the outcome? What if they had a negative outcome bet that Ryan Lavner is going to bogey the 18th hole? Okay, you can get a good number on that bet, and you yell in the middle of Ryan Lavner's backswing. This has always been a concern for the PGA Tour, and it's going to continue to be a concern for the PGA Tour. Do I think that's what the entire gallery at Shinnecock Hills was sort of latched onto as it did not get behind Wyndham Clark. No, I think our colleague Eamon Lynch caught on to something that maybe it's just the New York crowds. I'm not going to blame it on just the Long Island crowds. I felt like that was a step too far on Eamon's approach, but I think it was maybe a bigger picture. But gambling is a concern, and it was a part of this. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah, just to be clear, this is what Jordan Spieth was referring to. He talked about the Wyndham Clark situation at the U.S. Open. And I've seen various rationales for what actually happened on that final day. Was it the fact that these are just Long Island golf fans and this is how they act? Was it the fact that that fans did not like Wyndham Clark while he was trying to be a part of this redemption arc? Did they not like the idea that this was a blowout and if you paid a lot of money for those tickets that you wanted to be having some compelling action? Or did you have some money riding on the outcome and you had some money riding on the pursuers hunting down Wyndham Clark in a 6-shot lead on the final day? I think it was probably a confluence of events. I don't think it was one thing or the other, but that was why Jordan Spieth was talking about it. I'm laving this as well. It's also important to note that Jordan Spieth is a FanDuel partner. It's important to note that the PGA Tour is already having established relationships with FanDuel and DraftKings. They have these bet casts that are centered around the signature events, the PGA Tour. So the PGA Tour is leaning into gambling, full stop, like end of sentence. That is where they're going because that is where sports in general are going. There's a lot of money to be made. What's going to be interesting to see, Rex, and it's sort of, as you mentioned, been sort of hanging over that cloud of the PGA Tour for the past couple of years, but it has not come to fruition yet. We have not yet had an outcome that was determined by some Yahoo shouting in a backswing or shouting over a 4-foot putt. Hasn't happened in golf, hasn't happened to tennis on the world stage as well. So I understand the fear, yet it hasn't actually happened yet. And until that happens, until we have a direct outcome that has been influenced by these idiots who have action on the eventual outcome of the PGA Tour, it would seem preemptive. It would seem premature to do so. I do understand the suspicion. I do understand that this is something that the PGA Tour needs to keep a close eye on, especially because of its longstanding now relationship with these betting partners. But until we actually get to that point, seems a little premature, in my opinion. If you missed it over the weekend, Aaron Wise, who's been playing sporadically on the PGA Tour since 2023 after stepping away from the tour because of mental health issues, had a great interview with CBS's Amanda Baliones in which he opened up about the struggles. Rex, do you love or lav the idea that this could be actually one of the most important stories of the year, of a player being open, being transparent, and being vulnerable about the struggles that he has had competing at the highest level?
I love this story, and I love the idea that Aaron Wise, who clearly was dealing with a lot of things over the last few years, and such a talent, you covered him in college, you know what the expectations were and the ceiling was for a player like this, had won early in his career on the PGA Tour. And I think sometimes, again, this goes along with the idea that we dismiss the idea of winning. Sometimes we dismiss the idea of just getting to the top of the mountain. And sometimes you get here and you realize that maybe this isn't all it's cracked up to. It was interesting that we're coming up on the anniversary of Scottie Scheffler sort of opening up the fence a little bit last year at the Open Championship about the idea that it's not the winning that really drives me. There's maybe 5 minutes of joy and then you're back on the treadmill. And for Scottie, that's the part he loves. He loves being on the treadmill. He loves trying to be as prepared and he loves trying to work through whatever problem he might have at that time on the golf course. For some, like Aaron Wise, it's not so easy. I'll go to the Gary Woodland story about everything that he has gone through to get to the point at the Players Championship where he was willing to go public with the things, the PTSD he was dealing with. And those around him, his medical staff, and I would probably say his team, probably told him that you're not in the best profession to deal with something that's as specific as this. If you're worried about crowds, if you're worried about people coming up from behind you unexpected, you're in a fishbowl for your entire existence as a professional. Same thing for Aaron Wise in this particular case. It took a lot of courage for him to do this, to talk about it as well. And it took a lot of courage for him to come back. I will pause a little bit. I think Anthony Kim is probably going to end up being the comeback story of the year, but it's certainly one we can have a discussion about later.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think Gary Woodland would have to be in that conversation as well. The Gary Woodland story though, Rex, to me was more individual. It was more personal, and you were the one who was doing the interview. That was contextualizing the struggles that this individual player was having. I'm not sure that that's necessarily a widespread problem among the PGA Tour, and kudos to Gary for opening up to letting people know exactly what he was dealing with. Aaron Wise's affliction of anxiety and the stress and saying it was, you know, harmful for him to be out competing on the PGA Tour, that he wasn't enjoying it, that he wasn't himself, that he, you know, had issues trying to calm down and enjoy the process of being a PGA Tour professional. I think that's pretty widespread. I think that's pretty, I think it's pretty common on the PGA Tour. We've even seen Doc Redman, who's actually now the number one points earner on the Korn Ferry Tour. We've interviewed him a couple times on Golf Today so far in 2026. He took a similar break, not quite to the extent that Aaron Wise did, who again has played sporadically since 2023, but he stepped away for a couple of months just trying to rediscover his love for the game, trying to understand his priorities, trying to understand what he was doing out there. He has a young family at home, and why was he spending so much time? Why was he not getting anything out of his performances? Why did it always feel like he was run down and not sort of having the joy that he typically had while competing? I think that's pretty prevalent across the PGA Tour and certainly some of the minor league players as well. So kudos for to Aaron Wise for opening up a vein. And I think just more providing a window to what PGA Tour players are competing. These guys obviously are the best at their craft, the best in the world, best on the planet. They're also human beings too, who understand and go through the same human emotions that you and I do as well. Speaking of the John Deere Classic, Lucas Glover, who is going to be the PAC chairman beginning his term at the beginning of 2027, sounded off on the idea, Rex, of one of the talking points that the players who are going to be part of that championship series, aka Tier 1, cannot drop down and play the Challenger series, aka Tier 2, going so far as to saying it stinks. He's talking about tournaments like the Cognizant Classic, if it's the Nelson, maybe even the John Deere Classic. Again, that's all speculative of which tournaments are going to be part of that Challenger series. But are you loving or laving Lucas's take on that certain dynamic?
And again, I'll do the twofer on this one. I love his take, and I love the idea that the top players are not going to be able to cross over. I understand it.
We're going to have to circle back on these rules.
Yeah. We're going to have to get the rules. There's a lot of small print going on. Also, the small print is Glover right now is the chair of the Player Advisory Council. Next year, he goes on to the policy board. He will become a player director next year. So he'll be part of those long-term conversations, and it's a good thing that he will be. I had this exact same conversation with him at Colonial when the idea came up that the PGA Tour did not want players crossing over, either from Tier 1 to Tier 2 or vice versa, whatever the case may be. This one's going to be tough. And Lucas sort of explained to me when we were in Texas, the idea being that he would rather skip a lot of events where he knows he can't compete, and he named off some golf courses, to go play this week's event at the John Deere. He's won there. He's had so much success. We saw him play well. Again, it just made sense in his mind that I don't show up for points or paychecks at this point in my career. I show up because I want to win PGA Tour events. This was an opportunity for him to do that. I will say, if you go on to read the comments that he had last week about this, is he sat down and had long conversations with Brian Rollup about why. Why can't Tier 1 guys go down and play Tier 2 events? And it was laid out for him that they're going to be asking sponsors for a lot of money, a lot of commitment, just a lot right off the very top. So the idea that you have to be able to guarantee something close to 100% participation in these fields. They can't, but they have to try to get as close as possible. I understand where Lucas is coming from. I think this one is bothersome, but it's not nearly as bothersome as the conversation we had about the Canadian Open. That's the one that's going to be impossible, actually. There is no easy fix when the tour is split into two separate tiers, because either way, the Canadian Open is going to lose on this front. If it's a Tier 1 event, that means that you're not going to get all of those Canadians. There were 22 Canadians in the Canadian Open this year that had an opportunity to play for their national championship. They wouldn't have that if it was a Tier 1 event. If it's a Tier 2 event, that means you're not going to get the best Canadians, the guys who are Tier 1 guys playing down. It's a no-win situation.
Yeah, no-win situation is a great way to put it as well. Having a national open not be part of a championship series would certainly be a little bit of a head-scratcher. Look, best players in the world, even though they live 15, 20 minutes from PGA National, are not turning up for the Cognizant as it is right now. So the idea that you can't have these Tier 1 players dropping down to Tier 2, I'm laughing at. I asked Brian Rollup this exact question ahead of the Travelers Championship, and he said that our messaging to players is that we are trying to build something that is bigger than ourselves, not just one tournament and having a personal preference, or I like this golf course, or this tournament gave me a sponsor exemption, or this works in my schedule a little bit better than something else. We are trying to build the best overall product, can't cater it to each and every player's individual needs. Finally, Padraig Harrington was a runaway winner at the U.S. Senior Open, meaning that Stuart Singh and Padraig Harrington have absolutely dominated the senior majors so far in 2026. So Rex, in absence of a real true rivalry at the PGA Tour level, is Patty and Stewie Sink actually golf's best rivalry?
I don't know if it's golf's best rivalry, but it's a really good one. And it's, I will go ahead. It's among them. I would say it's right there alongside of, and we can kind of go down the list of things that we want to see. Maybe they're not there right now, but the idea of Rahm and Rory McIlroy going head to head at a major championship, or as we just had a conversation at a DP World Tour event, the idea that Scotty and Rory would go head to head at something closer as we get into the playoffs, that's very compelling. And that to me is going to be a brighter headline than this. But you look at what they've done, and I just kind of jotted the idea that they have won the best ball Super Grand Slam. So yeah, that's right. Best ball, Super Grand Slam. That means they've combined to win the last five majors on the senior circuit. That is an amazing number to me. They finished 1-2 the last 2 years at the U.S. Senior Open, and they still have another major at the Senior British Open coming up in just a few weeks. It's fun to watch because you see how both players are motivated. I remember having this conversation with Stuart Singh last year at the PNC Championship in Orlando about why he finally decided to pull the trigger and to move completely away from the PGA Tour. He still had status. He could have still played a handful of PGA Tour events. And he said, your window on the Champions Tour, PGA Tour Champions, is so small that he learned, he had to convince himself that I need to make the most of it. And he certainly is.
God, Patty is just such an amazing player, already a Hall of Famer. And I was seeing what he's done, just dominating in the senior majors as well. I am going to love this because I'm still sort of chapped that we have been robbed of a rivalry over the past couple of years because of the advent of LIV Golf. I thought we had something special brewing with Scottie Scheffler and Jon Rahm. They went to their respective tours. I thought we had something special with Rory McIlroy and Bryson DeChambeau. Bryson's game has fallen off over the past year and a half in the major championships. I thought we could have had something special, Rex, with Scottie Scheffler and Rory McIlroy, and maybe we still might. However, Rory McIlroy is scaling back all of his tournament appearances. We're just not going to have the frequency of a Scotty Rory duel in a rivalry, despite them playing on the exact same circuit. All right, that is a wrap on the Love It or Lave It. We also, Rex, have a world famous Voices in the Crowd segment that's coming up. Joseph Boza talked about Rory's 15 event minimum, something we were just talking about. We have former champions and challenger event venues that we want to discuss, as well as why you cannot make it more than a few minutes without checking your cell phone. Yes, all that and more coming up after this break.
57 minutes in, haven't looked once.
All right, Rex, it's time for our Voices in the Crowd segment. Another good week of listener questions. If you want to get involved, make sure you go into our YouTube comment section when the videos post on the Golf Channel page. This one from our friend Joseph Boza, who said, is it a big deal that Rory McIlroy is not going to fulfill the 15 event minimum on the PGA Tour?
If the tour follows the letter of the law, then it is going to be difficult because that means he's not going to maintain his membership, which means he's not going to get unlimited exemptions. Our friend Bob Herrick has done a lot of really good reporting on that. I would suggest you check out his Substack, I believe it is. I would say on this particular front, the PGA Tour is probably going to find a workaround simply because it's Rory McIlroy and there's a lot of reasons why you want to make that work. That's going to be difficult for Brian Rolapp and his team to do it. If not, the alternative is he plays the season on sponsor exemptions, which means he would play 12 times is the maximum instead of 14 times. So I don't think he's going to be heartbroken either way.
Yeah, there is a commissioner's clause. So Brian Rolapp could sort of rubber stamp it, even if Rory does not get to the minimum, which is 15 events. Looks like in 2026, he's going to be playing 14 times on the PGA Tour. We're also playing a handful of events and supporting his home tour, which is the DP World Tour. If it was 8 or 9 times he's trying to play on the PGA Tour, I would see that this would be a problem. Falling just one shy of the minimum, I don't see a huge issue. So how about this one, Rex, from Copium Dan? Said, we need to have championship and challenger series events at overlooked former major championship venues, talking about tournaments like DPC Harding Park, Olympic, even Chambers Bay, one of my personal favorites, the site of the 2015 U.S. Open. What do you think?
Venues is important in this entire conversation. You and I both have had long conversations with Brian Rolapp, members of his team. This isn't just about major markets. It's just not about established venues that we've gone to. It's about going to places that the PGA Tour has never been to. As a matter of fact, when you get into this match play conversation for what's going to happen in the playoffs, I love the idea that you could probably move this around to some really cool venues. Just like you just said, going back to Chambers Bay sounds really cool. I love Harding Park. I think it's a very special spot. I love this idea.
I love this idea as well. If we're going to be going to the big markets, you need to have a major You need to have a venue that is befitting of that market. Chambers was robbed back in 2015, the US Open, the one that Jordan Spieth won. I would so much rather see a PGA Tour event, a Championship Series event at Chambers Bay over Sahali, but that is just me. How about this one from Lee Scarbeck, who said, how is the Scottish Open being played this week in the PGA Tour going to fit into the Tier 1 model if just 75 tour players are a part of it because it is a co-sanctioned event, once they Rex?
I will answer for you. You're going to say it's going to be a Tier 1 event because you're saying every event is going to be a Tier 1 event. We're not going to have tiers in your universe starting in 2028. I will say this. It's a special event. It should be considered a Tier 1 Championship Series event. The problem is going to be the fact that the field is split. You have half the field PGA Tour players. Half the field is DP World Tour players. That's not going to work under this new model. So if it becomes a Tier 1 event, that means the PGA Tour is essentially going to take over the full field. And I don't think DP World Tour wants that to happen.
It is a Rolex Series event on the European Tour, so that would be very tricky. It's also a prestigious event. It's one of the tournaments, one of the national opens that the governing bodies, including the Masters Tournament, the Open Championship, they are giving invitations to their major championships by winning those tournaments. So, yes, that is a very tricky issue if it is a part of Tier 1. Wanted to make sure we get to this one, Rex. This was from a YouTube commenter who said, why can't Rex make it 33 minutes without checking his phone five times? Your rebuttal, please.
Had a lot more things to say. Go back and check it out on YouTube. Here I am playing TPC Sawgrass last week with my son. And even here, I can't be present. So yes, I have a problem with my phone. I will make this humble argument. It's my job. I have to be on the phone from time to time. I'm sorry if it's distracting.
Family time is the best time unless you are a member of Rex's family. Apologies to Trevor, who did not quite have his dad present for his round at TPC Sawgrass. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lath. If you like this show, you're in luck. Rex and I are going to be co-hosting Golf Today together all week long from our Golf Channel studios. Looking forward to that. Noon Eastern time coming to you on Monday and Tuesday, 11 a.m. on Wednesday. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. See you guys in the Golf Today studios on Monday.